Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Supersized Lies, How Myths About Weight Loss Are Keeping Us Fat, and the Truth About What Really Works, by Robert J. Davis, Ph.D., read by Robert J. Davis, Ph.D. Introduction. Horace Fletcher was a rich man, but there was one thing he couldn't buy: life insurance. Standing 5 feet 7 inches and weighing over 200 pounds, he was deemed too fat to be insurable. After applying and getting rejected several times, the bon vivant businessman came up with a way to slim down that would put him in the annals of weight loss history. Fletcher's method involved chewing, and chewing, and chewing. In fact, he chewed every mouthful of food until it completely liquefied and lost its flavor. Some food had to be munched more than 700 times before reaching oblivion. After 4 months of this interminable routine, Fletcher had dropped more than 40 pounds and lost 7 inches off his waist. Had he lived today, Fletcher might have become a YouTube sensation. But the year was 1898, so he spread the word about the benefits of ceaseless chomping by writing, lecturing, and giving press interviews. Having been sick and sluggish at his previous weight, the former athlete publicly displayed his chewing-induced vigor with stunts like backward flips off a diving board, lifting a man on his shoulders, and cycling 190 miles. Thanks to Fletcher's showmanship and charisma, his chewing regimen went viral in early 20th century America and Europe. Luminaries such as John D. Rockefeller, Thomas Edison, and Henry Ford embraced the practice, dubbed Fletcherism, as did Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, the nation's most famous physician. People formed chewing clubs and held parties to Fletcherize. What was a noontime chewing party called? A munchin. As Susan Yeager writes in her book, The 100-Year Diet, Sing Sing prison inmates, school children, the highest of high society, and the middlemost of the middle class all chewed and chewed. The Fletcherism craze died when its inventor did in 1919, but it lives on today as an example of a silly and unsound way to lose weight that nevertheless gained wide acceptance. Certainly it's not the only one. History is filled with laughable weight loss cures. Everything from bath salts and soaps that could supposedly wash away fat to cigarettes. Reach for a Lucky instead of a sweet, said ads for Lucky Strike cigarettes in the 1920s, to tapeworm eggs, which people ingested to consume the food in their intestines. Today, we're far more sophisticated about weight control than our forebears who fell for such hokum. Or so we think. In reality, much of the conventional wisdom about weight and obesity from experts in the media, and what many of us accept as established fact, is unproven or flat-out wrong. No one has been more outspoken on this issue than David Allison, an iconoclastic obesity researcher who's dean of the Indiana University School of Public Health, Bloomington. A groundbreaking paper he co-authored in the New England Journal of Medicine identified a number of widely believed obesity-related myths and unproven assumptions, which the study concluded are pervasive in both scientific literature and the popular press. While Allison says scientific knowledge regarding obesity has increased and that there have been advances in the field, he thinks that much of what we hear is nonsense and conjecture that masquerades as fact. Whether it's intermittent fasting or low-carb diets, fat-burning foods, or weight loss supplements, many of today's scientific approaches are actually no more substantiated than Fletcherism for achieving long-term weight control. While they may help us lose weight for a few months or even a year, they almost always fail eventually. In some cases, they actually make matters worse, and like cigarettes and tapeworm eggs, can cause other harms. These misguided ideas and practices, what they are, where they came from, and how they're hindering our quest to lose weight, are what this book is about. Sad stats. According to government surveys, the percentage of Americans trying to lose weight is on the rise, and roughly half of respondents say they've attempted to slim down in the past year. Three-quarters report that they've tried to lose weight at some point in their lives. We're spending big bucks to do so. By the latest estimates, the weight loss industry, which includes diet foods and drinks, commercial weight loss plans, health clubs, diet books, drugs and supplements, bariatric surgery, and medically supervised programs, is now worth more than $60 billion in the United States. As that figure has continued to balloon over the past several decades, so have our waistlines. According to the most recent data, more than 42% of U.S. adults now have obesity, up from 30% in 2000. During that time, the rate of people with severe obesity has nearly doubled, reaching almost 10%. Here are more sobering statistics to chew on. In 1990, no state had an obesity rate over 20%. Today, all 50 do, including those with the nation's leanest populations, such as Colorado and Hawaii. In 1980, the obesity rate among children and adolescents was 5.5%. By 2000, it had risen to 14%. Today, it stands at 19%. More than 70% of American adults are now classified as either overweight or obese. Worldwide, about 2 billion adults are overweight or obese. As if those figures weren't depressing enough, consider the high failure rates for long-term weight loss. Studies show that dieters gain back more than half of lost weight on average within 2 years, and 80% of it within 5 years. Overall, 97% of people eventually regain at least some of the weight they've lost. As the joke goes, I try to lose weight, but it keeps finding me. By whatever measure you choose, our efforts to control our weight are a colossal failure. You would think that this fiasco would lead to some kind of reckoning and a reevaluation of what we're doing. Instead, many obesity experts, weight loss gurus, and others who dispense advice just keep pushing the same failed solutions. For example, in a study noting the paradox that more people are continuing to get heavier while attempting to lose weight, the researchers don't question the effectiveness of measures like eating less and exercising more. Instead, they blame us, concluding that many people might not have actually implemented weight loss strategies or have applied a minimal level of effort. In other words, the problem is that we're not trying hard enough. Such an attitude is reminiscent of responses to medical treatment failures in bygone eras. When ineffective measures like bloodletting and mercury didn't work, doctors didn't blame the treatments. Instead, they often doubled down and administered the gruesome remedies even more aggressively. Just as hapless patients did back then, we frequently go along with experts' appeals to stay the course when it comes to our weight. You're biased. So, if there's no solid evidence for many weight control remedies, and we can see that they're not working, why do so many people, including researchers, health experts, and the general public, continue to cling to them? David Allison says one reason is cognitive biases, which are systematic errors in how we think. All people, even the smartest scientists, exhibit these biases, usually without realizing it. They include mere exposure effect. When people are repeatedly exposed to an idea, they're more likely to believe it. So if we hear over and over, for example, that weight control boils down to eating less and exercising more, we tend to accept it as true. The same goes for experts who encounter beliefs that are repeated in scientific papers and forums. Bandwagon effect. Also known as groupthink, this bias makes us more likely to adopt ideas or practices because everyone else seems to be on board. If the prevailing wisdom appears to be that, say, carbs are the main cause of weight gain, people tend to follow the herd and embrace the belief. Allegiance effect. This entails a strong attachment to a particular approach, whether keto, paleo, gluten-free, or something else, and a belief that it's superior to all others. When consumers or experts closely identify with a particular camp, they tend to dig in and have a hard time letting go. If confronted with evidence that refutes their belief, they may ignore it and instead embrace only information that supports their position, a phenomenon known as confirmation bias. Reasonableness bias. When something sounds reasonable, we have a greater tendency to believe it's true. For example, eating breakfast seems like a sensible thing to do, so people are more likely to accept it as a valid weight loss strategy without questioning it. Wishful thinking. When we badly want something to succeed and it doesn't, we may continue to believe that it will eventually work despite a lack of evidence to support our belief. Wishful thinking prompts experts to stick to the same strategies and consumers to try diets over and over. For both, the hope is that doing the same things will somehow lead to a different result, which, as the old saying goes, is the definition of insanity. Social media often reinforces these biases by increasing our exposure to particular ideas and giving the false impression that everyone agrees, when in fact there may be agreement only among the relatively small subset of people whose posts social media algorithms put in front of us. This selective exposure to information can also create and harden allegiances to weight loss creeds by surrounding us virtually with like-minded people. If you're inclined to believe, say, that veganism is the answer to weight control, you're likely to end up in a vegan echo chamber that further bolsters your belief. In addition, hearing about other people's weight loss triumphs through social media can lead us to falsely conclude that a particular approach will succeed for us because it worked or seemed to for them. When those other people are celebrities, the effect can be especially powerful. Many of us form so-called parasocial relationships with famous people, which are basically one-way friendships. Following them on Twitter and hearing about their every move, we may feel that we know them and can trust them as credible sources of information. Plus, we see their slim, beautiful bodies as evidence that they know what they're talking about, even though in reality, celebrities' weight-related practices and pronouncements are often scientifically baseless. The news media, which are a leading source of information about weight control for many of us, may also feed certain biases and mislead us, especially through coverage of research. Too often, news reports overstate the importance and definitiveness of studies, drawing sweeping conclusions that aren't justified while giving short shrift to key limitations. One such limitation is the type of research. Not all studies are created equal. There's a hierarchy, with test tube and animal research yielding the least definitive evidence. When reporting such studies, news stories may give a false impression, with statements like, "A new study says green tea helps you lose weight," which fails to make it clear that the you in the study were obese mice and the findings may not apply to people. Likewise, news stories often use misleading language when referring to observational studies, which show associations between two things, say, exercise and lower weight. If, based on such an association, a report tells us exercise causes weight loss, that's deceptive, because observational studies can't prove cause and effect. It could be that exercisers have other habits, like eating a healthy diet, that are actually responsible for their lower weight. While researchers try to control for such factors, their methods aren't foolproof. Randomized trials, which assign participants to receive either a treatment, such as a particular diet, or a placebo, are considered the gold standard of studies because they're able to prove causality. Still, they too can have shortcomings that limit their believability or relevance. For example, a trial that lasts 4 weeks can't tell us whether an intervention leads to long-term weight loss, and a study in which all the subjects are college students may not apply to middle-aged and older people. Often, media reports give little or no attention to crucial details such as these. Journalists can fall short when covering research for a number of reasons, including a lack of scientific training, tight deadlines, limited space or time in broadcasting, and the need to make bold statements, in other words, to sensationalize, to grab the audience's attention. As a journalist, I certainly don't defend shoddy coverage and routinely point out examples and speeches to colleagues. But to be fair, the blame doesn't lie solely with journalists. Distorted press releases also play a role. In many cases, reporters take their cues from materials put out by universities and scientific journals, and research shows that these releases often contain the same types of exaggerations and omissions that we see in media coverage. If you go back farther in the chain, you'll sometimes find that the studies themselves suffer from the same problems, with researchers' biases prompting them to overstate their findings or interpret the data in ways that are misleading. When these researchers are quoted in press releases or media reports, their spin typically goes unchallenged, giving us a skewed impression of reality. It's not just cognitive biases that can lead to these kinds of misrepresentations by researchers. So can financial biases. funding of weight-related studies by food companies, diet plans, pharmaceutical manufacturers, supplement makers, and others helps researchers survive professionally and allows them to conduct research that might not otherwise be possible. So it's easy to see why they would want to please their sponsors, or at least not bite the hand that feeds them. Researchers typically insist that funding doesn't influence their work, and it's true that corporate sponsorship doesn't necessarily render a study invalid. But there is evidence that nutrition studies sponsored by the food industry more often report favorable results to funders' interests than studies without industry funding. This may happen because researchers design their experiments in a way that's more likely to show benefits. They may frame the data to make those benefits appear as large or impressive as possible. Or they may emphasize findings that support the sponsor's interest and downplay or ignore those that don't. These nuances can be hard to detect and may not even be evident to the researchers themselves. Of course, the effects of money extend far beyond researchers. As I mentioned earlier, weight loss is a multi-billion dollar business, and many players in the industry help perpetuate myths because doing so is in their financial interest. If commercial weight loss companies and diet book authors can keep us believing there's a best diet, or food companies and supplement makers can keep alive the notion that the right products will magically melt away pounds, these sellers can keep taking our money. Because what they're selling usually doesn't work long term, the need for it never goes away, nor do sellers' profits. Truth or consequences? One obvious consequence of weight loss myths and misconceptions is wasted money and effort that could be spent on more effective strategies. This wouldn't be such an urgent problem if obesity were just a cosmetic issue. But in fact, it's a matter of life and death. The failure to control our weight is fueling a host of serious health problems, including an epidemic of type 2 diabetes. In addition, obesity is associated with an increased risk of heart disease, stroke, high blood pressure, osteoarthritis, sleep apnea, dementia, depression, fatty liver disease, gallbladder diseases, kidney disease, reproductive problems, certain cancers, and premature death. What's more, people with obesity are more prone to severe illness from the flu and COVID-19. It's not just the upper extremes of weight that can give rise to health issues. In some research, gaining as little as 10 pounds between early and middle adulthood is linked to an increased risk of diabetes, cardiovascular disease, severe arthritis, and certain cancers, as well as decreased odds of healthy aging. Other research has found that putting on 20 pounds or more is associated with an elevated risk of premature death, especially as people hit their mid-50s and beyond. Misguided approaches to weight control not only fail to adequately head off these threats, but also pose their own risks. As I detail in this book, these can include increased cravings, decreased enjoyment of meals, disordered eating, weight cycling, stress, and liver damage, to name just a few. Perhaps the most common side effect is weight stigma. Obesity myths contribute to it by reinforcing the false notion that we can control weight entirely through measures like strict dieting and exercise, and that people who don't succeed must be lazy, gluttonous, or lacking in self-discipline. Reflecting this view, 75% of respondents in one survey named insufficient willpower as a barrier to weight loss, putting it ahead of all other contributors, including genetics. Likewise, researchers responded to a New York Times column about rising obesity rates with comments such as these. Simple solution, eat less, work out more. This is self-created, self-imposed. Absolutely no one to blame but the individual. The fat, obese, simply have no self-control, discipline, or will to lead a healthy life. I've no sympathy for them as they have no respect for themselves. What happened to self-discipline? Don't blame your poor choices on anything other than you. Such attitudes are also common among healthcare professionals. Acknowledging this reality, Dr. David Prologo of Emory University has penned an open apology to overweight patients told to lose weight with diet and exercise. We have set them up to take the fall for our failed treatment approaches, he writes. When they came to us with the truth about tolerability, we loudly discredited them and said they were mentally weak, noncompliant, or lazy. While weight stigma undoubtedly has a pernicious effect on how society views and treats overweight people, it also negatively influences how they judge themselves. This internalized bias, which results in feelings of guilt, shame, and self-blame, can be especially harmful. Among other things, it's associated with depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, and binge eating, as well as a decreased likelihood of engaging in healthy behaviors like exercise. In such a way, internalized stigma not only damages people's health and quality of life, but also makes weight control even more difficult. That's what Angela experienced. After gaining 30 pounds in college, she was able to lose most of it. But maintaining the weight loss proved to be more difficult, in part because of an unhealthy relationship and a job that required a 5-hour commute several times a week. Eventually, Angela gained back all the weight, plus 30 pounds. She quit the job, ended the relationship, ate less, and exercised. Though she was trying to do all the right things, she had trouble unloading all the extra weight. Angela blamed herself and felt anger toward her body for not responding to the measures that had worked before. "It caused me to hate my body," she says. The self-blame and anger led her to think, why bother trying, and to punish herself for overeating. Her self-esteem plummeted, worsening her underlying depression. "Seeing myself in the mirror," she says, "I had a lot of negative talk back, which included feeling like a failure and feeling ashamed of myself." Her therapist challenged Angela to show the same compassion for herself that she showed to others. As part of this effort, Angela would ask herself, "What has my body given me today?" in order to shift the focus from what her body prevented her from doing to what it helped her do. Today, Angela tries to combat feelings of shame, anger, and failure by not worrying about hitting a certain number on the scale or fitting into a certain size. Instead, she focuses on what she can control and what she can do, like run, hike, and dance, and how she feels when she's doing it. In addition, she keeps a journal, which allows her to put her feelings into words and let go of some of the negative thoughts about herself and her weight. All of this has helped put Angela on a healthier path physically and emotionally. In addition to walking regularly and eating a healthy diet that includes lots of vegetables, she now has greater insight into her own emotions and what's behind them, knowledge that at age 30 has better equipped her to deal with not just her weight, but other challenges in her life as well. The road ahead. Throughout this book, you'll hear stories of real people like Angela who, in their battles to manage their weight, fell victim to the effects of misguided ideas but have found ways to overcome them. Unlike typical weight loss-related successes that we often hear about, the victories of these folks lie not in how many pounds or inches they've lost, but in how they've gained awareness of the futility of conventional thinking and have forged other paths that are more effective for them. Some experts say that instead of trying to change individuals' behavior, the focus should be on changing societal forces that contribute to obesity, such as gigantic restaurant portions, the availability of unhealthy, fattening foods everywhere we turn, and relentless marketing to prompt us to purchase them. Unquestionably, factors like these play a significant role, and in this book, I scrutinize some of the measures intended to address them, such as taxing soda purchases and requiring calorie counts on menus. But my main emphasis is on advice aimed at us personally. That's because while individual responsibility isn't the whole story regarding our weight, it's nevertheless a key part of it. To deny this, as some do, implies that we're helpless victims, incapable of exerting any personal control over our weight and health. That's simply not true. With the right strategies and the right expectations, we can, in fact, make meaningful and lasting changes in our own lives. This empowerment begins with knowing what advice to heed and what to ignore. To that end, chapters 1 through 7 deal with myths and misconceptions related to restrictive diets, calorie counting, exercise, fat-burning foods, meal timing, supplements and pills, and ideal weight. In each case, I delve into the history of the advice, showing in some instances how ostensibly cutting-edge trends are actually retreads of old ideas. In addition, drawing on my academic training in public health and epidemiology, I dissect the science, pointing out where and how specific claims deviate from the evidence. I also explain how unsupported claims undermine our weight control efforts and, in some cases, lead to harm. But this book isn't just about what's misleading or false. I also discuss what actually works, concluding each chapter with steps you can take to avoid wasting time, money, and effort. In the final chapter, I provide a comprehensive overview of effective strategies, which, as you'll hear, are far less complicated than many of the solutions we often hear about. Still, you won't find a 30-day or 7-step weight loss plan here because there's no such thing as a one-size-fits-all solution. Instead, I present a set of science-backed principles, which I hope can help you make more informed choices about the best ways to reach your own goals. In myth or truth sidebars along the way, you'll get quick takes on the veracity of statements that we frequently hear, such as, some foods have negative calories, drinking lots of water promotes weight loss, fruit is fattening, high sweat workouts burn more calories, and snacking is bad. I should note that my focus throughout the book is adults. This is in no way meant to downplay or ignore childhood obesity and the importance of addressing it. But young people often require different approaches than adults, especially to promote a positive body image and prevent a lifetime of internalized weight stigma. Trying to squeeze all this into the book wouldn't do the material justice, so I leave it to others to address the topic. One of my favorite cartoons, which appeared in The New Yorker, shows a woman in a bookstore walking by a section labeled Diet Books. She sees that the shelves are divided into two sections, fiction and nonfiction. The cartoon, which gets a knowing laugh when I show it to audiences, captures the feelings that most of us have about not just diet books, but weight loss advice in general. My hope is that this book will help you separate fiction from nonfiction as you navigate your weight loss journey and set you on a path to success. Chapter 1. Pick Your Villain. Husky, full-seated, spare tire. They're words I vividly remember clothing store clerks and family friends using to describe my physique when I was a child. Though intended to be polite, the observation still stung because even at age 8, I knew exactly what they meant. I was fat. In an effort to help me slim down, my mother instructed me to forego bread. The advice reflected what she'd learned growing up, that starchy foods are the main culprit when it comes to weight. I complied with her directive, at least in her presence, even at my favorite restaurant, and reluctantly removed the buns from my McDonald's hamburgers. When I got to college in the 1980s and became interested in nutrition, I laughed as I recalled Mom's weight loss prescription. According to what I was now learning, she'd had it backwards. The main cause of weight gain was fat, not starches, so she should have told me to skip the burger, not the bun. Had I been an overweight child today, my mother, who keeps up with the latest nutrition thinking, might well have fingered a different culprit and put the kibosh instead on the sugary soda that I typically ordered with my hamburgers. Luckily for me, I became thinner as I grew. But our society has not outgrown our insatiable desire to find a dietary villain that we can blame for our expanding waistlines. We lurch from one to another, from fat to carbs to gluten to soda. Or, depending on which diet you follow, the enemy might be animal products, legumes, cooked foods, acidic foods, or foods our ancestors didn't eat. It's human nature to gravitate toward good versus evil explanations for complex problems. We see the same phenomenon in other areas of life, including politics. While having a clearly defined enemy may satisfy our primal need for a simple narrative to make sense of things, it can do harm if it distracts us from what really matters. That's what's happened in our battle with weight. We've been led down one dead end after another, chasing elusive bad guys that keep changing. A variety of forces have cheered us on in this chase, including diet peddlers, the news media, and food manufacturers that are more than delighted to sell us all the fat-free, carb-free, or other enemy-free foods we can eat. Nutrition researchers, obesity experts, and government agencies also bear responsibility for leading us astray by overstating the certainty of the science when it comes to culprits. What research does show is that weight loss diets that demonize whole categories of foods may work in the short term, but
sample complete. Ready to continue?